Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 29th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I'll be your host for this, our last program of the year. As 2012 comes to its inglorious end, we're facing two existential crises for our nation and for the world. The first is the threat of a hyperinflationary explosion, as the financial system is bankrupt and can never be bailed out. There's no way you can bail out the huge volumes of derivative debt and obligations, no matter how many regimes of quantitative easing are attempted by Bernanke at the Federal Reserve and his cohorts in the European Union. And it's this hyperinflationary collapse which is fueling the second great crisis, that of the danger of a likelihood of a nuclear World War III. We have documented on this program that U.S. President Barack Obama is in an alliance with the terrorists of Al-Qaeda. And you can see this with our fact sheet up on the LaRouchePact.com website. And that this alliance exists because both Al-Qaeda and Obama are functioning as part of an Anglo-Saudi geopolitical operation to force a back down by Russia and China, which is not going to happen. So for this reason alone, he must be ousted, as he's an agent of a foreign power. And this would be a necessary precondition to get the policy changes needed to avoid the hyperinflationary collapse and World War III. These policy changes have been repeatedly presented by Lyndon LaRouche, who again last night on his weekly webcast presented his three-part plan to avoid a blowout of the transatlantic economies and to start us back on the path to a real durable recovery. At LaRouche PAC, we've been mobilizing both to oust Obama and to get this three-part program implemented. Again, this last week, our organizers were all over Washington, D.C., briefing congressmen, staffers, the man on the street. We've been deployed nationally on this, and we're going to be doing the same thing next week. But it becomes clear that we're facing a different kind of problem than most people think. The crucial problem is, on the one side, the absence of true statesmen who can rise to the occasion, and on the other side is the absence of an educated and committed population to defend our republic. In our nation's past, we've always had such statesmen, true patriots who are committed to creating, to preserving, and to advancing our republic. Leaders such as Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and Alexander Hamilton, Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and a handful of others. Will such a statesman emerge today? Is that a possibility? Over the last month, there's been a renewed interest in one of those statesmen, our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, due to a new film that was directed by Steven Spielberg about Lincoln's last major accomplishment in his last months in office, the passage of the 13th Amendment. This film has provided a service in a way by inspiring a discussion about Lincoln, even though there are problematic aspects of the film. On today's program, we're going to discuss Lincoln, the real statesman of principle, who saved our republic largely through his leadership. We're not here to do a film review, though we may touch on some of the aspects of the Spielberg movie. But instead, by looking at Abraham Lincoln, we intend to provide insights into what qualities of leadership are required today if our republic is to survive. Joining me on the program will be an historian of note and author of several books on the American system, published books, and some very fascinating unpublished manuscripts. He's written extensively for the Executive Intelligence Review, including on this topic. I'm talking about Anton Chaitkin, who's been our guest a number of times before, and also Phil Rubenstein, who's a leader of the LaRouche movement and who has brought the issues addressed by Lincoln and the Founding Fathers alive in classes and discussions repeatedly in over the years. So, Tony and Phil, welcome to the program.
Hello, Harley.
Hi.
Let me begin by asking each of you for a brief summary of your thoughts on the importance of looking at Lincoln today during this time of crisis. What can we learn from Lincoln? Tony, why don't you begin?
We've had, since the murder of President Kennedy, a decline not only in our economy, but a disaster of public thinking, public morality, into real psychosis. You said people should be more committed. I look at that in the other sense of the term. A lot of the public needs to be committed in the sense of an asylum. Lincoln came into office as president after many, many years as a political leader and thinker. And the United States, aside from the secession that he faced, had 30 years of the naked power and rule of oligarchies in London, New York, and the southern slave owners. This had been set up by the presidency of Andrew Jackson, who took down the powers of the government to interfere with those financiers and London's power, so that the government was not in the business of defending any part of the population. And Lincoln changed the purpose of the United States, restored the original purpose, and gave it new power as a nation, and transformed world affairs. And this is what's going to have to happen now. There's a clause in a phrase in his second inaugural address where he said that each side in the war looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. He brought about, his leadership and the people that worked with him brought about an astounding shift in world affairs, and that's what's going to happen now if we're going to save the United States. So I think that's the standpoint from which we need to discuss Lincoln right now.
Well, Tony, one of the points that you brought up is that there had been from Jackson forward, a British domination of banking and government, and that, as Lyndon LaRouche commented recently, we lost our sovereignty then, and we've never really fully recovered it. And clearly, again, we're dealing with the same problem with Barack Obama and the control by Tony Blair and the Queen.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the assassinations of Lincoln and John F. Kennedy, both of them were murdered by a hit team that was sponsored by the British. The one for Lincoln coming out of Canada that was running terrorism into the United States, and John Wilkes Booth was up there getting his money and his directions and came back with a team. Kennedy murdered by a team of assassins that was based in Spain that came out of the fascist groups in Algeria, managed by the British and their stooges. They came over and did this job in Dallas. In both cases, they're attempting to do a coup against the United States, and it was, I would say, even more successful after Kennedy. We haven't recovered from that, but Lincoln, for sure, understood the war that he was in as a war, and I'm not just talking about the Civil War, but the political war between the imperial system of which the South and slavery was a part, and the idea of raising the value of labor through having a nation that extends civilization. Those are the two sides.
Tony, let's come back to that in a moment, because I want to give Phil a chance to jump in here and give us his thoughts on why looking at Lincoln today is so important.
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but one interesting way to look at it, from I think, is that a lot of the specific form of brainwashing and degradation that has come in since the Kennedy assassination, and even going back to the FDR period, a great deal of the problem that he had was the Confederacy. In other words, the Confederacy because Lincoln made it very clear in his last public speech on Louisiana, and then the inaugural that Tony referred to, made it clear that he was what his approach to the to a reconstruction of the nation was going to be. And with his I think it's very clear it was with the recognition that a good deal of the problem resided in New York City, the capitulation to British free trade and banking policies, and that he was going to move with what he had done as the president, the economic, industrial development, scientific development. I think it's underestimated, again, the quality of intellect that you're dealing with. And so he made it clear what he was going to do, despite the fact that it wasn't spelled out in every detail. And the fact that he was assassinated, that he had been, you know, stuck with Johnson, led to the unwinding, in many ways, particularly in the South, of his view of what the nation would become as a single nation. And he knew throughout, in terms of the world, he very much saw the issue at stake. Could a nation, could a republic survive, particularly in a world ruled by oligarchies? He was opposed by the British, by the French oligarchy, you know, virtually everybody in Europe opposed the Union or was happy to see the Union go. He even had a hard time expressing anything when he was assassinated. So soon after, you had, by the end of the 19th century, the Jim Crow laws, but also the whole states' rights, which, you know, and the economic outlook that prevails today, that's part of the insanity that Tony was referring to. And I think the other side of it is the historic background.
I was just going to ask you, Phil, because you mentioned this question of a whole nation or one nation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he was very much influenced by John Quincy Adams on this, the creation of the American nation state.
Absolutely. I think there's very good, I mean, Tony may know more on this, but the two things, I mean, not only was Lincoln the congressman who stood up in his one term under the eyes of John Quincy Adams and opposed the Mexican War, but he was part of the Whigs. He was organizing for internal developments in Illinois that were destroyed by the crash of 1837. But I think one of the most interesting things, given the way Lyndon LaRouche has focused on this issue of statesmen being able to forecast, Quincy Adams at least twice that I know of recorded in the early 1830s while he was a congressman said that if the slave powers continue, and of course this is the Andrew Jackson Van Buren period, if the slave powers continue, if we lose the Second National Bank, it would be inevitable that we would end up in a civil war. And secondly, he said that it could be that under the circumstances of a civil war, using the commander-in-chief role of the president, that would be a moment to abolish slavery or emancipate the slaves. Now, Lincoln very much was involved with and educated by Adams and his strata and his followers. And Charles Sumner, in the early part of the war, came to Lincoln and told him, or at least reiterated to Lincoln, this conception of an emancipation under the conditions of war. And it's clear that Lincoln, who himself in 1854, 1856, saw that the nation was being ripped apart and that this was a conscious policy, Lincoln took that road and said, as the commander-in-chief, I have the power to liberate slaves in the states still in rebellion. Now, despite all that's been said, it was an emancipation, and it did lead, ultimately, to the 13th Amendment. And, you know, I think you have to understand that battle that Quincy Adams carried almost single-handedly in the 1830 to 1848 period in the Congress, and of course was the author really of the Continental conception of a republic, and that was the issue in Lincoln's mind and the other people's mind: could a republic of this nature survive? And he said this over and over again.
Tony, let me get back to you on this question of the 30 years before Lincoln. We just had this work published by Michael Kirsch. I know you've done a lot of work in the past on Andrew Jackson. I know you worked with Michael on it. And this is available on the website, The End of the Credit System, Andrew Jackson, by Michael Kirsch. One of the points Michael makes is the extent to which the oligarchy, the British, controlled the media, controlled the press, and turned the population, which in general supported the policies of Quincy Adams, turned the population either indifferent or against the bank. Given that that continued for so many years, how did Lincoln even get elected?
I don't think the population was against the bank. The population was for Jackson. And they were stimulated by the British-controlled media to continue to support him after they had originally supported him because he was a military hero. Jackson tore down the bank and took down all the powers of the government. As you said, the population supported, all throughout the Union, the policies of government-sponsored construction of transportation facilities. And they did support the bank in general. I think it's important to look at where Lincoln was in that period. When he was a teenager, John Quincy Adams was president. He was born in 1809. Quincy Adams was president in the late 1820s. And so Lincoln saw the fantastic improvements sponsored by the nation, by the federal government and by state governments. And then when he was in the legislature as a 27-year-old, he was the leader of the group of people who sponsored, from a state standpoint, the building of a huge railroad network, canals and railroads. And it's very important when we have modern writing, a representation of Lincoln, and they completely leave out what his lifelong commitment was. It's reflected in his presidency when he vastly increased the scope and power of the U.S. economy, made the dollar valuable and added to the value of the whole economy. But in Illinois, as the Bank of the United States was torn down, he continued to fight for this kind of development against the wave in Washington. And the result in building up the city of Chicago from nothing and building up this vast railroad network, literally floating locomotives on boats to get out there because there was no railroad between there and the east, resulted in the Midwest becoming this great power. And most important, Lincoln's biographers and other so-called historians attack this program of Lincoln. They call it the folly that led to the state's bankruptcy. Instead of saying that the British and the Jackson closing the Bank of the United States bankrupted the country, actually what Lincoln did there made it into the powerhouse of the nation. So then when he came into the White House in 1861, he expanded on his earlier work for this policy, made the railroad stretching from the Atlantic to the Pacific $60 million by the federal government, $4 million from private investment. He virtually created the American steel industry overnight by government design with high tariffs. He launched scientific agriculture, including free western land for farmers, establishing the agriculture department, promoting farm machinery and cheap tools. He recruited immigrants to increase the population as fast as possible. He started free higher education throughout the United States, the land-grant college system, and flooded the country with currency in an opposite intention to the Federal Reserve. It was not inflationary. it was it added to the value of the dollar by vastly increasing the productive powers. So this point of view of Lincoln, I would put under the category of his conception that he is fighting for self-government. That is, the people are entitled to have a government that they own that is dedicated entirely to their welfare and not to their enemies in the international bankers and the London. And he's against cheap labor. He wants to increase the value of labor. How do you do that? You have to make labor more valuable by upgrading industry and energy throughput per person. You've got to have a nation that has the power to defend and improve civilization. It means high wages, but you only get the high wages by bringing in this high-powered, energy-dense industry. And he wrote on productive versus non-productive labor. He ridiculed non-productive labor as an economic concept, something that the dunces today could learn from. But you have to strip away the impediments to economic progress, such as the high cost of transport, by making modern new transport. Take away usury. Take away the banker's usury. And stop war. People forget that there was no war for a generation after the Civil War, because just like FDR and Kennedy, his idea was, we don't want to have any war. He had a powerful military. No more wars after this. He didn't bring the war on himself. After the war, that's the end of it.
All right, so you're listening to the LaRouche Show. This is the 29th of December, 2012, and we're talking with Anton Chaykin and Phil Rubenstein about Abraham Lincoln. This is quite interesting. Now, if you look at what Tony just reported, Phil, and you look at this question of Lincoln's commitment to what was called at the time the American system, you can see why the British Empire wanted to stop it, because it was antithetical to the British Empire in the same way the American Revolution was taking the British Empire as its target. To what extent, Phil, to what extent was Lincoln clear on the question of who the enemies of the country were? Obviously not the slave owners in themselves, because they themselves didn't have that much power. How aware was he of the problems with the crowd in Boston, the banking crowd in New York, and their alliance with London?
Well, I think he was quite aware of it. I mean, you see it during the Civil War, clearly, because, you know, he didn't want a war with the British. He didn't want a second war. That came out during the Trent Affair. But that was the reason that he decided what he decided. He knew quite clearly that Russell, Lord John Russell, and so forth, were waiting for the moment to endorse the Confederacy. And he was quite aware of that from a military standpoint, and he raised this question on a number of occasions. He didn't want but he knew the aristocracy, as he saw it, the oligarchy of Europe, was preparing for the moment. I mean, I think one way to look at it slightly negatively is, I think this was, as people now know, the whole story behind Lee's excursion into Gettysburg to get something on Northern territory that would allow the British, who were in his camp, there were British journalists and observers in Lee's camp waiting to signal a victory that would allow for the endorsement of the Confederacy. The British were building ships. They were backing up the raiding by the Confederacy, and Lincoln was completely aware of this. But I think even more, one of the more interesting examples, or I could give two examples, one of the more, a little bit on the humorous side, was often his speech when, I think it was 1938, the Lyceum speech.
1838.
Is given as an example of Lincoln trying a lot of high-flown rhetoric and so on and so forth. Now, if you look at what Lincoln was doing, he was attacking the sub-treasury. Yep. And this was, of course, after Jackson under Van Buren. But he was attacking the whole economic policy as a a usurpation by the financial powers of the development of the United States. I mean, he certainly saw this in the Civil War when he went to New York to Wall Street to get money for the Civil War. He couldn't get it. That's what ended up, and he was quite aware of the British manipulations of gold and so on and so forth to destroy this. I think the other element is a very interesting speech that he gives. It's September 30th, either 1859 or 60, at one of these state fairs, agricultural state fairs, where he goes through a great deal of exactly what Tony was talking about, the need to mechanize agriculture, the improvement in the productivity of labor, the priority of labor over capital, and in particular, he hits very hard at the oligarchical idea that the stupider the labor is, the better it is. He says these people would you'd almost think they'd be better. They'd think they'd be better off if they had a human being without the head. And then he goes into a sort of interesting discussion of that the hand is connected to the mind, and that you have to have that development and universal education in order to have an advancing culture. So I think, you know, given the circumstances that we saw in him fighting against even in his early, you know, in his late 20s and early 30s, and the specific reference to the financial manipulations under Jackson and Van Buren, and then his very clear, of course, the speech to the Manchester Working Men's Association, he makes it very clear that he's addressing something entirely different in Europe than the leadership, the aristocratic leadership that he had absolutely no faith in, no trust in whatsoever.
So, and Tony, therefore, this idea of the American system, Lincoln was not just talking about it, he was actually implementing it.
Yes, and I think that it's important to challenge the public now. People revere Lincoln, just like they revere John Kennedy. And most people, thinking people, revere Franklin Roosevelt. People revere Lincoln, but they don't agree with him. Southerners or somebody might say we need slavery or whatever, but on Lincoln's whole life, his commitment to this American system, to the upgrading of civilization, to the opposite of British laissez-faire system, why don't people agree with that today? Why is the political consensus in the United States for these psychotic wars and for bailing out the bankrupt banking system instead of doing this industrialization all over the world that Lincoln proposed? And I think that we should go back to the second inaugural address and look at Lincoln's courageous state of mind. Here it is, almost the Civil War is almost won. This is in the beginning of 1865. And nevertheless, he says, I'm not going to predict anything in some glorious finish. And furthermore, the public should not be arrogant about God being on our side. We've committed wrongs in the North and the South. And the wrongs are the wrong of slavery, in particular the North's running slaves and so forth. But I'm rather than bring that up because of the particulars that Lincoln was talking about, we should have that same state of mind. This, people today should have the courage. That 10% that Lyndon LaRouche has said has to take the leadership now, have to have the courage to take on the public and ask, why do you disagree with Lincoln? Why do you disagree with Kennedy? Why do you disagree with FDR? Why do you think that destroying one nation after another, that having cheap labor and free trade, is a good idea? Why are you against heavy industry and steel and nuclear power when these leaders were for vastly increasing the power of man to subdue nature? What do they understand that you don't understand? Why are you acting like a fool? Lincoln took on the public repeatedly in his own state when he was in the legislature and then as president. That's the attitude we have to have now if we're going to save the country.
Now, I want to get to a couple of specific issues that are very much along the lines of what you just pointed out, Tony, where people have heard things, just like people, you have these so-called libertarians, Austrian school, right-winger, anti-Fed types, who actually believe that Andrew Jackson fought the Rothschilds, fought against the Rothschilds. It's these kinds of mythologies that have been promoted. One of the arguments that I think people really don't understand is this question of Lincoln and the Union, which they then counterpose to Lincoln saying he would save the Union even if he didn't have to free the slaves, that therefore he was for the Union and not really for freeing the slaves. So I'd like you to address that, because I've heard you discuss it before, and I think it's a very important part of debunking the popular mythology, including what comes out all the time in the media.
Well, you know, I think besides the fact, you know, if you look at first of all, Lincoln was a great polemicist. I mean, sometimes I'm, you know, his writings or his speeches certainly rise to the level of poetry, but he was also a great polemicist. And in the famous letter, you know, where he says, you know, if I have to free all the slaves for the Union, I would do that. If I could have the Union without any slaves, I would do that. He's basically saying to people, what would you have me do, number one, to save the Union? What would you sacrifice the Union? What are the terms that you would think about this? What's your actual commitment? And, of course, he was faced with a situation that I think, and it's very clear throughout the development of the war, that he knew that effectively, because of something that it's true is rarely raised, Lincoln made a very strong point in the first inaugural about the peculiar interest, the peculiar economic policy of the South. He saw it as an economic interest, and he knew that that was totally different than the American system or the concept that Tony was outlining, which was his commitment through his entire life, not something that he just came to accidentally as a practical politician during the war, which is, I think, one of the myths about Lincoln, that he stumbled around and managed to practically come to some right conclusions because he was a good-hearted soul. But this was his lifelong commitment. And he very much, as some others, saw the Union, the United States, as a peculiar nation in the world, based on this concept of the development of the creative powers of the citizenry in very explicit ways and their role in this idea of a republic, of a self-governing republic.
So these were principled strategic concerns of his.
That's right. And so he was very clear, and he was also very clear that if you didn't have the Union, and remember, this was the British idea. They wanted to split the country up into, however, 3, 4, 5. You had the earlier threat of secession of the New England states around the Hartford Convention, which was clearly run by the Boston banking and New York banking factions. Later in the war, you had the threat of the, what was then the Northwest seceding in the middle of the war to try, which was neighboring Canada and so forth. So he knew that if the Union was dissolved, slavery would spread, slavery would dominate. That those people who, equally well, the abolitionists who said, "Let the South go. We don't want to be tainted morally by their presence." Lincoln opposed that as strongly as anything, because he knew that if the Union was dissolved, then you would have slavery not only in the South, but spreading into the West because of the powers of the financial powers that ruled. So for him, the Union as a grand strategic and moral question and slavery as a moral question were inseparable.
You can turn that around also, that from the very beginning, from the arguments over the Constitution, the Southern slave owners and the ones who were more radical in looking for a slavery as a system feared the creation of a powerful central government and a powerful nation, because it would, by the nature of things, lead to the abolition of slavery. It would lead to the rise of labor. It would lead to the increase in the independence of the population in general. And so you, the idea in the up to Jackson was that if the United States continued to develop as an industrial power, slavery would become outmoded, it would become outstripped, and people would transfer their investments out of it. If slavery continued as it did because of Jackson, then where the Union was weakened and the nation was weakened, its powers were weakened, then slavery would destroy the basis for its continued existence. If as long as slavery was contained and could not spread, it was going to die. It's not economically viable. Just like cheap labor and imperialism lead to the extinction of civilization if they're continued, they're not economically viable. Lincoln understood this, and his point of view was to create a powerful nation that he had certain tactical considerations in keeping the middle states with this war to knock out the Confederacy. But at the same time, we had he developed from scratch, from having no army, the world's greatest military force, and this force had as its intention to crush the Confederacy. What's going to be the outcome of that? You're going to destroy the system that runs slavery. So if somebody were to say, well, he really wasn't against slavery, what's he doing with an army at war to crush the Confederacy? How were the slaves actually freed? They were freed by the army. And Lincoln was the commander-in-chief. He wasn't just that in name only. He actually ran it from top down. He had to replace his generals who were bad. And he had, furthermore, the conception, which later lasted for a long time in our military and industrial leaders, patriots, that you have to have powerful industry and a powerful educated workforce to back up national defense and make it work. So all these things were going to lead to the abolition of slavery.
Tony, let me ask you another question and then get Phil's thoughts on it. That always comes up again from people who are these self-styled experts on freedom and free trade and so on. They cite Lincoln taking dictatorial powers,
yes,
the repeal of habeas corpus, that this proves he was a dictator. This set in motion the current corporate state and so on and so forth. How do you respond to that?
I'm going to read to you the second clause in Article 1, Section 9 of the United States Constitution. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. That's the United States Constitution. Did we have a rebellion? Did the public safety require it? When somebody is trying to stop the recruitment of soldiers into the army, and we're in a war, and the war is inside the United States, do you think that is a matter of public safety? Lincoln did, and he took those measures with habeas corpus. I will also say that he was similar to two other men in his reverence for the Constitution, and the other two men are John Quincy Adams and George Washington. That the three of those men saw the United States Constitution and the idea of an orderly, lawful society based on the popular rule through representative government, that this was something that you could treat as sacred. And contrary to him being a dictator, for example, the Pacific Railroad, the Homestead Act, all these things that were passed, the high tariffs, these things were put through by Congress, not by Lincoln, not by fiat. And of course, the abolition of slavery was done by the Congress in the Constitutional Amendment. So you could actually miss what Lincoln did as a strategic leader because of his reticence to do something with the presidential powers that would be outside of the scope of the United States Constitution. That's how far he went to protect and defend this country and its Constitution.
And Phil, let me ask you something about this, because I know you read many, maybe all of the letters Lincoln wrote while he was president, many of which dealt with these kinds of legal questions, of requests for pardons, and some of his, even people in the cabinet thought he was too kind-hearted and soft in this. How do you see this in relationship to what Tony just said?
Well, I think, you know, Lincoln had a great respect for human life, and he didn't think it was a trivial thing to take a life. Furthermore, he was very clear that the discipline of a citizen army, which is what really came to the fore for almost the first time in the Union Army, in the recruitment to the Union Army and so forth. And so the idea of disciplining a citizen army by, you know, executing young soldiers who go AWOL and so on and so forth. It wasn't just softness on his part. His conception of the sense of mission and purpose of the Union Army, so therefore the morale of the Union, was predicated on an entirely different conception of what drew these soldiers in. They were not mercenaries. They weren't professionals. They were citizens defending the Union. And so he looked at all of these cases that way, and only in the extreme cases where he thought it actually represented a threat, where, you know, this was a threat to the discipline, or in the case of slave traders, he would allow executions to go forward. But in the case of the Union Army itself, he wanted to bring a different conception, which, by the way, in general, one of the generals who agreed with him, at least in part, was Grant. So he was not quite as insistent on this. And I think it's quite clear that when Lincoln went for the habeas, and he took it, he went in a corridor where there was agentry and Confederate infiltration, the Van Landingham case, you know, with the excuses, he did the speech in Ohio where the war wasn't. But, of course, it was all about the state of mind and the recruitment of the Union forces. So Lincoln was completely rigorous on these things. And I think in some sense, you know, to think about Lincoln, you also have to look back from the way LaRouche looks at leadership and statesmanship, and he's often referenced, because Lincoln, as John Quincy Adams and Washington and so forth, Lincoln was thinking of the entire future of humanity. You know, he said, we shall be remembered until the last generation whether or not we can do this. We have to secure a future not only for the United States. And he was very clear on this. You know, at the last, you know, maybe it's a little bit, I don't want to spend too much, it's not the dictionary meaning of terms, but the last words in the second inaugural is, and for all nations. So he was thinking of this, and I think there's many proofs of it, as something that would have an effect on the world's population for all time.
That's also clear from the Gettysburg Address, that he's not just speaking about the United States, but about the conception of the Republic. Now, let me ask you a question that also comes up from the new movie Lincoln. which largely covers the 13th Amendment and the fight to get that implemented. One of the things that is often said is that this was taken by Lincoln as something that had to be pushed through in a hurry because he was afraid the war was going to end and there would not have been a definitive statement against slavery. What would you say about that, Tony?
Part of the problem was the power in New York. You saw some of these scoundrels in the movie up in New York City. Congressman Wood and some of these other guys that were working with a combination of the Confederacy and Wall Street, all of them representing British ties to British financiers. And he saw this power that is inside the United States. It wasn't swept away in the South, and it was ruling in New York City. It was ruling in the British Empire. We had to do two things. We had to make this sweeping change in the United States, which also included using 200,000 black troops to make sure that we brought about a victory and changed the conception of the country in that way. But we also had to show the world in the most powerful way what we were about as a nation. This was, again, a shot heard around the world, not just the freeing of the slaves, but the entire conduct of the Union in saving the country and in creating this astonishing powerhouse of industry and of skilled labor. This was something that was seen, along with this, the moral aspect of freeing the slaves. This was seen throughout the world in the same way as the original Declaration of Independence in the United States. This was vastly popular in the world, and over gradually, in 10 to 15 years, what Lincoln did in his economic policy, his national policy, was copied everywhere in the world. Some places got away with it, some places didn't. But that was the start of nationalism throughout the world. And this, you see this phenomena again with Franklin Roosevelt and with John Kennedy, that the world is startled, is made happy, made excited, and infused with hope that they can do the same thing. So I think that that is what Lincoln is looking at. The power of the enemy in New York City, particularly representing the British imperialists and their friends, and that has to be overcome in the Constitution, and then doing it for the world.
Phil, did you have anything you want to add on this question of the fight for the 13th Amendment?
Two short things. I think, you know, it's somewhat of a specious argument. I mean, Lincoln was intelligent enough to know that the outcome of reconstructing the nation, of bringing the southern states back in, et cetera, even with all the strictures and the fact that he wanted them brought in under the best circumstances, nonetheless left some important question marks, as Tony brought up, which way would some of these people go under different circumstances. I think the movie plays a completely unnecessary game is by playing up the so-called manipulations. You know, he bribed this one, he offered a job to that one, which was a minor part of what he did. I think Thaddeus Stevens has a quote on it when he says, "These were some of the roughest political methods used by the purest man I ever knew." So I think that, you know, that Lincoln was doing something from the standpoint of an absolute commitment to make sure that what had been gained in the Civil War on these questions was not lost. So I think the the typical sort of 20th, 21st century view of these things is, well, this was just a pragmatic politician. He might have been a good human being. He might have had a moral streak. He learned things, and he managed to fight his way through this, misses the whole point. This, you know, that's where I think the whole question comes up. It misses not only the whole person of Lincoln in terms of what he represented in terms of his history, but it misses the whole fight of the nature of the United States, which, as Tony pointed out in the beginning, is very much, what was he doing? Lincoln was organizing the population. He was saying, this is what we stood for. This is the economic policy. This is our respect for changing that policy forever and moving forward from that standpoint. And so he was addressing this to the future of the American population, not listening to opinion, not, you know, many people wanted to compromise and negotiate. That was a lot of his problem with the generals, you know, McClellan being the leading example, but not the only one, who figured win a battle and negotiate. And, you know, Lincoln was absolutely opposed to that. And I think that's much more what was reflected in the 13th Amendment than anything else. His willingness to take on the population and give them an ever deeper sense of what this was really all about.
I think one other thing I'd just like to see what you both have to say on it is that one of the errors that modern historians succumb to in looking at Lincoln is this whole question of Lincoln, was it depressive? There's a whole new grinding mill of stories on this. He was depressed. Was he manic depressive? And they take it, obviously, from the fact that there was a tragedy, that after this, that the Civil War was a tragedy, over 600,000 people killed. Lincoln, the assassination of Lincoln was a tragedy. But on the other hand, what they're missing is what the two of you have been discussing these last 50 minutes, namely that he was dealing with the most profound principles of self-government that had ever been brought forth on the planet, and that this is a very serious, solemn business. And the fact that Lincoln at times had self-deprecating humor it doesn't show manic depressive tendencies, huh?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a little bit like the question, if somebody's out to get you, are you paranoid if you think somebody's out to get you? I mean, Lincoln knew the stakes involved. I think there's the famous incident or the famous period where he writes this August 23rd note to the cabinet. And it's interesting what he says, because sometimes the point can be missed. He said, I expect to lose the election. And this was because of the lack of a sense that the Union was going to win, which only came with the fall of Atlanta and so on and so forth. But he said, I expect to lose. I further expect that whoever replaces me will not be committed to the Union, will not be committed to the emancipation. And therefore, I propose that between the election and the inauguration, we guarantee that those two factors win out over whoever replaces me. Now, if you think of somebody dealing with that kind of situation, with that kind of sense of his own, you could say it's a glimmering of a sense of immortality, that what he does has to have an existence into the future and for the betterment of human beings, then you realize that this idea of being depressed is, you know, it's from the standpoint of someone who is engaged in looking at the world from the smallest standpoint.
Let me say that Lincoln saw that this war was an attack on civilization, that specifically since around 1830 there'd been a Southern secession attack building up. The elements of that were in the United States and in the British imperial system going back much earlier than that. He saw himself as being qualified by temperament and intellect to do the leadership which was necessary in the face of the failure of other people's leadership, and as is almost always the case, surrounded by brutally stupid and cruel people.
Like, let me ask you, because the other point that comes up is people say, well, Lincoln was always ambitious, but in fact, this was actually a mission as opposed to a personal ambition.
It was a mission. He was confident in the sense that he knew that he had this ability to stand up in the. I think the way to understand this point of view is to look at the Symposium or other dialogues of Plato. What he's up against in powerful opponents and the stupidity of people who follow them. So, are there times when you're feeling sad or doubtful? Of course, you're human. This is recorded in Jesus in the Gospels. But the idea that is uppermost in his mind, which he gets again from his early childhood and from his teenage years and young adulthood, and also from his historical studies, that we are engaged in this monumental, beautiful task of making a new world, of making man a better species. And so when he's put into the position and puts himself in the position of defending civilization, from this deliberate attack on civilization, he knows that the outcome of this has to be exactly the reverse. So this is a massive responsibility on his shoulders, which sometimes hurts a great deal. But that's why, you know, he has to use humor, as you said, to keep himself from help keep sanity all around him. But the discussion of his psychology has to take into consideration, just take this point. Ward Lehman, Lamon, his bodyguard when he was president, an old friend, said after he was assassinated that from the time he took off for Washington on the train from Illinois until the day he was killed, there was not a single hour when his life was not threatened. That's what he lived under. And that was the tone of the whole society for decent leaders in this 30-year period leading up to the Civil War, the period inaugurated by that mass killer, Andrew Jackson.
Well, this hour has really flown by, and I want to take a couple minutes to do a few announcements. As I said, we've come to the end of the year. We have the change of the Congress on January 3rd, the inauguration, which we still may be able to derail on January 21st. The listeners of this program ought to take to heart what you just heard from Tony Chaitkin and Phil Rubenstein about the individual qualities of a leader, of a statesman, that this is your nation. This is the future of your children, your families, your neighbors, and that we're seeing it destroyed today under Barack Obama, in the same way that the period begun by Andrew Jackson nearly destroyed this nation. But we've also seen leadership can emerge, and this is your responsibility to provide leadership, to back LaRouche Pack, to organize people to see Lyndon LaRouche every Friday night, where he's giving a class, a series of classes on the American system, what Tony and Phil were discussing today. So I hope you were inspired by this discussion. I know I was, and I think the important thing is we have to go into this new year with a determination to oust this British operation in the United States immediately and put an end to the British Empire and free the people of England in the process. So we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition of the LaRouche Show. Tony and Phil, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.